After the siege began, food supplies became short. Indians in Michigan sent food via a plane that landed inside the encampment. The next day, FBI agents arrested the pilot and a doctor from Michigan who had hired the plane. In Nevada, 11 Indians were arrested for taking food, clothing, and medical supplies to South Dakota. In mid-April, three more planes dropped 1,200 pounds of food, but as people scrambled to gather it up, a government helicopter appeared overhead and fired down on them while ground fire came from all sides. Frank Clearwater, an Indian man lying on a cot inside a church, was hit by a bullet. When his wife accompanied him to a hospital, she was arrested and jailed. Clearwater died. There were more gun battles, another death. Finally, a negotiated peace was signed, in which both sides agreed to disarm. The Indians had refused to disarm while surrounded by armed men, recalling the 1890 massacre. The United States government promised to investigate Indian affairs, and a presidential commission would re-examine the 1868 treaty. The siege ended, and 120 occupiers were arrested. The U.S. government then said that it had re-examined the 1868 treaty, found it valid, but that it was superseded by the U.S. power of eminent domain, the government's power to take land. The Indians had held out for 71 days, creating a marvelous community inside the besieged territory. Communal kitchens were set up, a health clinic, and hospital. A Navajo Vietnam veteran. There's a tremendous amount of coolness considering that we're outgunned. But people stay because they believe. They have a cause. That's why we lost in Vietnam, because there was no cause. We were fighting a rich man's war for the rich man. In Wounded Knee, we're doing pretty damn good morale-wise, because we can still laugh. Messages of support had come to Wounded Knee from Australia, Finland, Germany, Italy, Japan, England. One message came from some of the Attica brothers, two of whom were Indians. You fight for our Earth Mother and her children. Our spirits fight with you. Wallace Black Elk replied, Little Wounded Knee is turned into a giant world. After Wounded Knee, in spite of the deaths, the trials, the use of the police and courts to try to break the movement, the Native American movement continued. In the Akwesasne community itself, which put out Akwesasne notes, the Indians had always insisted their territory was separate, not to be invaded by the white man's law. One day, New York State Police gave three traffic tickets to a Mohawk Indian truck driver, and a council of Indians met with the police lieutenant. At first, he insisted that he had to follow orders and give out tickets, even in Akwesasne territory, although he obviously was trying to be reasonable. He finally agreed that they would not arrest an Indian in the territory or even outside of it without first having a meeting with the Mohawk Council. The lieutenant then sat down and lit a cigar. Indian Chief Jokiso, a distinguished-looking man with long hair, rose and addressed the lieutenant with a serious voice. There is one more thing before you go, he said, looking straight at the lieutenant. I want to know, he said slowly, if you've got an extra cigar. The meeting ended in laughter. Akwesasne Notes continued to publish. On its poetry page, late autumn 1976, appeared poems reflecting the spirit of the times. As Abernathy wrote, I am grass growing and the shearer of grass. I am the willow and the splitter of laths. Weaver in the thing woven, marriage of willow and grass. I am frost on the land and the land's life, breath and beast and the sharp rock underfoot. In me the mountain lives and the owl strikes, and I in them. I am the sun's twin, mover of blood and the blood lost. I am the deer and the deer's death. I am the burr in your conscience. Acknowledge me. And this from Buffy St. Marie. You think I have visions because I am an Indian. I have visions because there are visions to be seen. In the 60s and 70s, it was not just a women's movement, a prisoners' movement, an Indian movement. There was general revolt against oppressive, artificial, previously unquestioned ways of living. It touched every aspect of personal life, childbirth, childhood, love, sex, marriage, dress, music, art, sports, language, food, housing, religion, literature, death, schools. The new temper, The new behavior shocked many Americans. It created tensions. Sometimes it was seen as a generation gap, the younger generation moving far away from the older one in its way of life. But it seemed after a while to be not so much a matter of age. Some young people remained straight, while some middle-aged people were changing their ways, and old people were beginning to behave in ways that astounded others. Sexual behavior went through startling changes. Premarital sex was no longer a matter of silence. Men and women lived together outside of marriage and struggled for words to describe the other person when introduced. "I want you to meet my friend." Married couples candidly spoke of their affairs, and books appeared discussing open marriage. Masturbation could be talked about openly, even approvingly. Homosexuality was no longer concealed. Gay men and gay women, lesbians, organized to combat discrimination against them, to give themselves a sense of community, to overcome shame and isolation. All this was reflected in the literature and in the mass media. Court decisions overruled the local banning of books that were erotic or even pornographic. A new literature appeared, The Joy of Sex and others, to teach men and women how sexual fulfillment could be attained. The movies now did not hesitate to show nudity, although the motion picture industry, wanting to preserve principle as well as profit, set up a classification system, R for restricted, X for prohibited to children. The language of sex became more common both in literature and in ordinary conversation. All this was connected with new living arrangements, especially among young people. Communal living arrangements flourished. A few were truly communes, that is, based on the sharing of money and decisions, creating a community of intimacy, affection, trust. Most were practical arrangements for sharing the rent, with varying degrees of friendship and intimate association among the participants. It was no longer unusual for men and women to be roommates, in groups of two or three or larger, and without sexual relations, as practical, unselfconscious arrangements. The most important thing about dress in the cultural change of the 60s was the greater informality. For women, it was a continuation of the historic feminist movement's insistence on discarding of feminine, hampering clothes. Many women stopped wearing bras. The restrictive girdle, almost a uniform of the 40s and 50s, became rare. Young men and women dressed more nearly alike, in jeans, in discarded army uniforms. Men stopped wearing neckties. Women of all ages wore pants more often, unspoken homage to Amelia Bloomer. There was a new popular music of protest. Pete Seeger had been singing protest songs since the 40s, but now he came into his own. His audience is much larger. Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, singing not only songs, but songs reflecting the new abandon, the new culture, became popular idols. A middle-aged woman on the West Coast, Malvina Reynolds, wrote and sang songs that fit her socialist thinking and her libertarian spirit, as well as her critique of the modern commercial culture. "Everybody now," she sang, "lived in little boxes, and they all came out just the same." Bob Dylan was a phenomenon unto himself. Powerful songs of protest, personal songs of freedom and self-expression. In an angry song, Masters of War, he hopes that one day they will die and he will follow their casket in the pale afternoon. "A hard rain's a-gonna fall" recounts the terrible stories of the last decades, of starvation and war, and tears, and dead ponies, and poisoned waters, and damp, dirty prisons. "It's a hard rain's a-gonna fall." Dylan sang a bitter anti-war song, "With God on Our Side," and one about the killer of the black activist Medgar Evers, only a pawn in their game. He offered a challenge to the old, hope to the new, for the times they are a-changin'. The Catholic upsurge against the war was part of a general revolt inside the Catholic Church, which had for so long been a bulwark of conservatism, tied to racism, jingoism, war. Priests and nuns resigned from the church, opened their lives to sex, got married and had children, sometimes without bothering to leave the church officially. True, there was still enormous popularity for the old-time religious revivalists, and Billy Graham commanded the obedience of millions. But now there were small, swift currents against the mainstream. There was a new suspicion of big business, of profiteering as the motive for ruining the environment. There was a re-examination of the death industry, of money-making funerals and profitable tombstones, as in Jessica Mitford's The American Way of Death. With the loss of faith in big powers, business, government, religion, there arose a stronger belief in self, whether individual or collective. The experts in all fields were now looked at skeptically. The belief grew that people could figure out for themselves what to eat, how to live their lives, how to be healthy. There was suspicion of the medical industry and campaigns against chemical preservatives, valueless foods, advertising. By now, the scientific evidence of the evils of smoking, cancer, heart disease, was so powerful that the government barred advertising of cigarettes on television and in newspapers. Traditional education began to be re-examined. The schools had taught whole generations the value of patriotism, of obeying authority, and had perpetuated ignorance, even contempt for people of other nations, races, Native Americans, women. Not just the content of education was challenged, but the style, the formality, the bureaucracy, the insistence on subordination to authority. This made only a small dent in the formidable national system of Orthodox education, but it was reflected in a new generation of teachers all over the country and a new literature to sustain them. Jonathan Kozel, Death at an Early Age, George Denison, The Lives of Children, Ivan Illich, Deschooling Society. Never in American history had more movements for change been concentrated in so short a span of years. But the system, in the course of two centuries, had learned a good deal about the control of people. In the mid-70s, it went to work. In the early 1990s, a writer for the New Republic magazine, reviewing with approval in the New York Times a book about the influence of dangerously unpatriotic elements among American intellectuals, warned his readers of the existence of a permanent adversarial culture in the United States. It was an accurate observation. Despite the political consensus of Democrats and Republicans in Washington, which set limits on American reform, making sure that capitalism was in place, that national military strength was maintained, that wealth and power remained in the hands of a few, there were millions of Americans, probably tens of millions, who refused, either actively or silently, to go along. Their activities were largely unreported by the media. They constituted this permanent adversarial culture. The Democratic Party was more responsive to these Americans, on whose votes it depended. But its responsiveness was limited by its own captivity to corporate interests, and its domestic reforms were severely limited by the system's dependency on militarism and war. Thus, President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty in the 60s became a victim of the war in Vietnam, and Jimmy Carter could not go far so long as he insisted on a huge outlay of money for the military, much of this to stockpile more nuclear weapons. As these limits became clear in the Carter years, a small but determined movement against nuclear arms began to grow. The pioneers were a tiny group of Christian pacifists who had been active against the Vietnam War. Among them were a former priest, Philip Berrigan, and his wife, Elizabeth McAllister, a former nun. Again and again, members of this group would be arrested for engaging in nonviolent acts of dramatic protest against nuclear war at the Pentagon and the White House, trespassing on forbidden areas, pouring their own blood on symbols of the war machine. In 1980, small delegations of peace activists from all over the country maintained a series of demonstrations at the Pentagon, in which over 1,000 people were arrested for acts of nonviolent civil disobedience. In September of that year, Philip Berrigan, his brother Daniel, the Jesuit priest and poet, Molly Rush, a mother of six, Anne Montgomery, a nun and counselor to young runaways and prostitutes in Manhattan, and four of their friends made their way past a guard in the General Electric plant at King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, where nose cones for nuclear missiles were manufactured. They used sledgehammers to smash two of the nose cones and smeared their own blood over missile parts, blueprints, and furniture. Arrested, sentenced to years in prison, they said they were trying to set an example to do as the Bible suggested, to beat swords into plowshares. They pointed to the huge allocations of taxpayers' money to corporations producing weaponry. GE drains $3 million a day from the public treasury, an enormous larceny against the poor. Before their trial, they became to be known as the Plowshares Eight. Daniel Berrigan had written in the Catholic Worker, "I know of no sure way of predicting where things will go from there, whether others will hear and respond, or how quickly or slowly, or whether the act will fail to vitalize others, will come to a grinding halt then and there, its actors stigmatized or dismissed as fools. One swallows dry and takes a chance." In fact, the movement did not come to a halt. Over the next decade, a national movement against nuclear weapons developed, from a small number of men and women willing to go to jail to make others stop and think, to millions of Americans frightened at the thought of nuclear holocaust, indignant at the billions of dollars spent on weaponry while people were in need of life's necessities. Even the very middle American Pennsylvania jurors who convicted the Plowshares Eight showed remarkable sympathy with their actions. One juror, Michael DeRosa, told a reporter, "I didn't think they really went to commit a crime. They went to protest." Another, Marianne Ingram, said the jury argued about that. "We really didn't want to convict them on anything. But we had to because of the way the judge said the thing you can use is what you get under the law." She added, "These people are not criminals. Here are people who are trying to do some good for the country. But the judge said nuclear power wasn't the issue." Reagan's huge military budget was to provoke a national movement against nuclear weapons. In the election of 1980 that brought him into the presidency, local referenda in three districts in western Massachusetts permitted voters to say whether they believed in a mutual Soviet-American halt to testing, production, and deployment of all nuclear weapons, and wanted Congress to devote those funds instead to civilian use. Two peace groups had worked for months on the campaign, and all three districts approved the resolution, 94,000 to 65,000, even those that voted for Reagan as president. Similar referenda received majority votes between 1978 and 1981 in San Francisco, Berkeley, Oakland, Madison, and Detroit. Women were in the forefront of the new anti-nuclear movement. Randall Forsberg, a young specialist in nuclear arms, organized the Council for a Nuclear Weapons Freeze, whose simple program, a mutual Soviet-American freeze on the production of new nuclear weapons, began to catch on throughout the country. Shortly after Reagan's election, 2,000 women assembled in Washington, marched on the Pentagon, and surrounded it in a great circle, linking arms or stretching to hold the ends of brightly colored scarves. 140 women were arrested for blocking the Pentagon entrance. A small group of doctors began to organize meetings around the country to teach citizens the medical consequences of nuclear war. They were the core of the Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Dr. Helen Caldicott, the group's president, became one of the most powerful and eloquent national leaders of the movement. At one of their public symposia, Howard Hyatt, dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, gave a graphic description of the results of one 20-megaton nuclear bomb falling on Boston. 2 million people would die. Survivors would be burned, blinded, crippled. In a nuclear war, there would be 25 million severe burn cases in the nation, yet all existing facilities could take care of only 200 cases. At a national meeting of Catholic bishops early in the Reagan administration, the majority opposed any use of nuclear weapons. In November 1981, there were meetings on 151 college campuses around the country on the issue of nuclear war. And at local elections in Boston that month, a resolution calling for increased federal spending on social programs by reducing the amount of our tax dollars spent on nuclear weapons and programs of foreign intervention won a majority in every one of Boston's 22 wards, including both white and black working-class districts. On June 12, 1982, the largest political demonstration in the history of the country took place in Central Park, New York City. Close to 1 million people gathered to express their determination to bring an end to the arms race. Scientists who had worked on the atom bomb added their voices to the growing movement. George Kistiakowsky, a Harvard University chemistry professor who had worked on the first atomic bomb and later was science advisor to President Eisenhower, became a spokesman for the disarmament movement. His last public remarks before his death from cancer at the age of 82 were in an editorial for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in December 1982. I tell you as my parting words, forget the channels. There simply is not enough time left before the world explodes. Concentrate instead on organizing, with so many others of like mind, a mass movement for peace such as there has not been before. By the spring of 1983, the nuclear freeze had been endorsed by 368 city and county councils across the country, by 444 town meetings and 17 state legislatures, and by the House of Representatives. A Harris poll at this time indicated that 79% of the population wanted a nuclear freeze agreement with the Soviet Union. Even among evangelical Christians, a group of 40 million people presumed to be conservative and pro-Reagan, a Gallup poll sampling showed 60% favoring a nuclear freeze. A year after the Great Central Park demonstration, there were over 3,000 anti-war groups around the country, and the anti-nuclear feeling was being reflected in the culture, in books, magazine articles, plays, motion pictures. Jonathan Schell's impassioned book against the arms race, The Fate of the Earth, became a national bestseller. A documentary film on the arms race made in Canada was forbidden to enter the country by the Reagan administration, but a federal court ordered it admitted. In less than 3 years, there had come about a remarkable change in public opinion. At the time of Reagan's election, nationalist feeling, drummed up by the recent hostage crisis in Iran and by the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, was strong. The University of Chicago's National Opinion Research Center found that only 12% of those it polled thought too much was being spent on arms. But when it took another poll in the spring of 1982, that figure rose to 32%. And in the spring of 1983, a New York Times CBS poll found that the figure had risen again to 48%. Anti-militarist feeling expressed itself also in resistance to the draft. When President Jimmy Carter, responding to the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan, called for the registration of young men for a military draft, more than 800,000 men, 10%, failed to register. One mother wrote to the New York Times. To the editor, 36 years ago, I stood in front of the crematorium. The ugliest force in the world had promised itself that I should be removed from the cycle of life, that I should never know the pleasure of giving life. With great guns and great hatred, this force thought itself the equal of the force of life. I survived the great guns, and with every smile of my son, they grow smaller. It is not for me, sir, to offer my son's blood as lubricant for the next generation of guns. I remove myself and my own from the cycle of death. Isabella Leitner. Former Nixon aide, Alexander Haig, warned in an interview in the French journal Politique Internationale that there might reappear in the U.S. the conditions that forced President Nixon to stop the draft. There is a Jane Fonda on every doorstep, he said. One of the young men who refused to register, James Peters, wrote an open letter to President Carter. Dear Mr. President, on July 23, 1980, I am expected to report to my local post office for the purpose of registering with the Selective Service System. I hereby inform you, Mr. President, that I will not register on July 23rd or at any other time thereafter. We have tried militarism, and it has failed the human race in every way imaginable. Once he was in office, Ronald Reagan hesitated to renew draft registration because, as his Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, explained, President Reagan believes that resuming the draft to meet manpower problems would lead to public unrest comparable to that in the 60s and 70s. William Beecher, a former Pentagon reporter, wrote in November 1981 that Reagan was obviously concerned, even alarmed, by the mounting voices of discontent and suspicion over emerging U.S. nuclear strategy, both in the streets of Europe and more recently on American campuses. Hoping to intimidate this opposition, the Reagan administration began to prosecute draft resistors. One of those facing prison was Benjamin Sassway, who cited U.S. military intervention in El Salvador as a good reason not to register for the draft. Aroused by Sassway's civil disobedience, a right-wing columnist, William A. Rusher of the National Review, wrote indignantly that one heritage of the 60s was a new generation of anti-war teachers. Almost certainly there was a teacher, or teachers, who taught Benjamin Sassway to look at American society as a hypocritical, exploitative, materialistic roadblock on the path of human progress. The generation of the Vietnam protesters is now in its early 30s, and the academicians among them are already ensconced in the faculties of the country's high schools and colleges. What a pity our jurisprudence doesn't allow us to reach and penalize the real architects of this sort of destruction. Reagan's policy of giving military aid to the dictatorship of El Salvador was not accepted quietly around the nation. He had barely taken office when the following report appeared in the Boston Globe. It was a scene reminiscent of the 1960s, a rally of students in Harvard Yard shouting anti-war slogans, a candlelight march through the streets of Cambridge. 2,000 persons, mostly students, gathered to protest U.S. involvement in El Salvador. Students from Tufts, MIT, Boston University, and Boston College, the University of Massachusetts, Brandeis, Suffolk, Dartmouth, Northeastern, Vassar, Yale, and Simmons were represented. During commencement exercises that spring of 1981 at Syracuse University, when Reagan's Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, was given an honorary doctorate in public service, 200 students and faculty turned their backs on the presentation. During Haig's address, the press reported nearly every pause in Mr. Haig's 15-minute address was punctuated by chants: human needs, not military greed, get out of El Salvador. Washington guns killed American nuns. The last slogan was a reference to the execution in the fall of 1980 of four American nuns by Salvadoran soldiers. Thousands of people in El Salvador were being murdered each year by death squads sponsored by a government armed by the United States, and the American public was beginning to pay attention to events in this tiny Central American country. As has been true generally in the making of U.S. foreign policy, there was no pretense at democracy. Public opinion was simply ignored. A New York Times CBS News poll in the spring of 1982 reported that only 16% of its sampling favored Reagan's program of sending military and economic aid to El Salvador. In the spring of 1983, it was disclosed that an American physician named Charles Clement was working with the Salvadoran rebels. As an Air Force pilot in Southeast Asia, he had become disillusioned with U.S. policy there, having seen firsthand that his government was lying and refused to fly any more missions. The Air Force response was to commit him to a psychiatric hospital, then to discharge him as psychologically unfit. He went to medical school and then volunteered to be a doctor with the guerrillas in El Salvador. There was much talk in the American press in the early 80s about the political cautiousness of a new generation of college students, concerned mostly with their own careers. But when, at the Harvard commencement of June 1983, Mexican writer Carlos Fuentes criticized American intervention in Latin America and said, "Because we are your true friends, we will not permit you to conduct yourselves in Latin American affairs as the Soviet Union conducts itself in Central European and Central Asian affairs," he was interrupted 20 times by applause and received a standing ovation when finished. Among my own students at Boston University, I did not find the pervasive selfishness and unconcern with others that the media kept reporting, in deadening repetition, about the students of the 80s. In the journals they kept, I found the following comments. A male student: "Do you think anything good that has happened in the world had anything to do with government? I work in Roxbury, a black neighborhood. I know the government doesn't work, not for the people of Roxbury, and not for the people anywhere. It works for people with money." A graduate of a Catholic high school: "America to me is a society, a culture. America is my home. If someone were to rob that culture from me, then perhaps there would be reason to resist. I will not die, however, to defend the honor of the government." A young woman: "As a white middle-class person, I've never felt discriminated against at all. But I'll say this. If anyone ever tried to make me sit in a different schoolroom, use a different bathroom, or anything like that, I would knock them right on their ass. the people are the last ones that need their rights stated on paper, for if they're abused or injusticed by government or authority, they can act on the injustice directly. When you look at the statements of rights and laws, it's really government and authority and institutions and corporations that need laws and rights to insulate them from the physicality, the directness of the people. Beyond the campuses, out in the country, there was opposition to government policy not widely known. A report from Tucson, Arizona, early in the Reagan presidency, described demonstrators, mainly middle-aged, protesting at the federal building against U.S. involvement in El Salvador. Over 1,000 people in Tucson marched in a procession and attended a mass to commemorate the anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero, who had spoken out against the Salvadoran death squads. Over 60,000 Americans signed pledges to take action of some sort, including civil disobedience, if Reagan moved to invade Nicaragua. When the president instituted a blockade of the tiny country to try to force its government out of power, there were demonstrations around the country. In Boston alone, 550 people were arrested protesting the blockade. During Reagan's presidency, there were hundreds of actions throughout the nation against his policies in South Africa. He obviously did not want to see the white ruling minority of South Africa displaced by the radical African National Congress, which represented the black majority. Chester Crocker, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, in his memoirs, called Reagan insensitive to the conditions under which blacks lived there. Public opinion was strong enough to cause Congress to legislate economic sanctions against the South African government in 1986, overriding Reagan's veto. Reagan's cuts in social services were felt on the local level, as vital needs could not be taken care of, and there were angry reactions. In the spring and summer of 1981, residents of East Boston took to the streets. For 55 nights, they blocked major thoroughfares in the Sumner Tunnel during rush hour in order to protest cutbacks in funds for fire, police, and teachers. The police superintendent, John Doyle, said, "Maybe these people are starting to take lessons from the protests of the 60s and 70s. The Boston Globe reported, "The demonstrators in East Boston were mostly middle-aged, middle or working-class people who said they had never protested anything before." The Reagan administration took away federal funds for the arts, suggesting that the performing arts seek help from private donors. In New York, two historic Broadway theaters were razed to make way for a luxury 50-story hotel after 200 theater people demonstrated, picketing, reading plays and singing songs, refusing to disperse when ordered by police. Some of the nation's best-known theater personalities were arrested, including producer Joseph Papp, actresses Tammy Grimes, Estelle Parsons, and Celeste Holm, actors Richard Gere and Michael Moriarty. The budget cuts spurred strikes across the country, often by groups unaccustomed to striking. In the fall of 1982, United Press International reported, "Angered by layoffs, salary cuts, and uncertainty about job security, more school teachers throughout the country have decided to go on strike. Teacher strikes last week in 7 states, from Rhode Island to Washington, have idled more than 300,000 students." Surveying a series of news events in the first week of January 1983, David Nyan of the Boston Globe wrote, "There is something brewing in the land that bodes ill for those in Washington who ignore it. People have moved from the frightened state to the angry stage, and are acting out their frustrations in ways that will test the fabric of civil order." He gave some examples. In Little Washington, Pennsylvania, in early 1983, when a 50-year-old computer science teacher who led a teacher's strike was sent to jail, 2,000 people demonstrated outside the jailhouse in his support, and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette called it the largest crowd in Washington County since the 1794 Whiskey Rebellion. When unemployed or bankrupt homeowners in the Pittsburgh area could no longer make mortgage payments and foreclosure sales were scheduled, 60 pickets jammed the courthouse to protest the auction, and Allegheny Sheriff Eugene Kuhn halted the proceedings. The foreclosure of a 320-acre wheat farm in Springfield, Colorado, was interrupted by 200 angry farmers who had to be dispersed by tear gas and mace. When Reagan arrived in Pittsburgh in April 1983 to make a speech, 3,000 people, many of them unemployed steelworkers, demonstrated against him, standing in the rain outside his hotel. Demonstrations by the unemployed were taking place in Detroit, Flint, Chicago, Cleveland, Los Angeles, Washington, over 20 cities in all. Just around that time, Miami blacks rioted against police brutality. They were reacting against their general deprivation as well. The unemployment rate among young African Americans had risen above 50%, and the Reagan administration's only response to poverty was to build more jails. Understanding that blacks would not vote for him, Reagan tried, unsuccessfully, to get Congress to eliminate a crucial section of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which had been very effective in safeguarding the right of blacks to vote in southern states. Reagan policies clearly joined the two issues of disarmament and social welfare. It was guns versus children, and this was expressed dramatically by the head of the Children's Defense Fund, Marion Wright Edelman, in a commencement speech at the Milton Academy in Massachusetts in the summer of 1983. "You are graduating into a nation and world teetering on the brink of moral and economic bankruptcy. Since 1980, our President and Congress have been turning our national plowshares into swords and been bringing good news to the rich at the expense of the poor. Children are the major victims. Our misguided national and world choices are literally killing children daily. Yet governments throughout the world, led by our own, spend over $600 billion a year on arms, while an estimated 1 billion of our world's people live in poverty and 600 million are under or unemployed. Where is the human commitment and political will to find the relative pittance of money needed to protect children?" She urged her listeners, "Pick a piece of the problem that you can help solve while trying to see how your piece fits into the broader social change puzzle." Her words seemed to represent a growing mood that worried the Reagan administration. It withdrew some of its proposed cutback, and Congress eliminated others. When, in its second year, the administration proposed $9 billion in cuts in support for children and poor families, Congress accepted only $1 billion. The Washington correspondent of the New York Times reported, "Political concerns about the fairness of Mr. Reagan's programs have forced the administration to curtail its efforts to make further cutbacks in programs for the poor." The repeated elections of Republican candidates, Reagan in 1980 and 1984, George Bush in 1988, were treated by the press with words like landslide and overwhelming victory. They were ignoring four facts: that roughly half the population, though eligible to vote, did not; that those who did vote were limited severely in their choices to the two parties that monopolized the money and the media; that as a result, many of their votes were cast without enthusiasm; and that there was little relationship between voting for a candidate and voting for specific policies. In 1980, Reagan received 51.6% of the popular vote, while Jimmy Carter received 41.7%, and John Anderson, a liberal Republican running on a third-party ticket, received 6.7%. Only 54% of the voting-age population voted, so that, of the total eligible to vote, 27% voted for Reagan. A survey by the New York Times found that only 11% of those who voted for Reagan did so because he's a real conservative. Three times as many said they voted for him because it is time for a change. For a second term, running against former Vice President Walter Mondale, Reagan won 59% of the popular vote. But with half the electorate not voting, he had 29% of the voting population. In the 1988 election, with Vice President George Bush running against Democrat Michael Dukakis, Bush's 54% victory added up to 27% of the eligible voters. Because our peculiar voting arrangements allow a small margin of popular votes to become a huge majority of electoral votes, the media can talk about overwhelming victory, thus deceiving their readers and disheartening those who don't look closely at the statistics. Could one say from these figures that the American people wanted Reagan or Bush as president? One could certainly say that more voters preferred the Republican candidates to their opponents, but even more seemed to want neither candidate. Nevertheless, on the basis of these slim electoral pluralities, Reagan and Bush would claim that the people had spoken. Indeed, when the people did speak about issues in surveys of public opinion, they expressed beliefs to which neither the Republican nor Democratic parties paid attention. For instance, both parties through the 80s and early 90s kept strict limits on social programs for the poor on the grounds that this would require more taxes, and the people did not want higher taxes. This was certainly true as a general proposition, that Americans wanted to pay as little in taxes as possible. But when they were asked if they would be willing to pay higher taxes for specific purposes like health and education, they said yes, they would. For instance, a 1990 poll of Boston area voters showed that 54% of them would pay more taxes if that would go toward cleaning up the environment. And when higher taxes were presented in class terms, rather than as a general proposal, people were quite clear. A Wall Street Journal NBC News poll in December 1990 showed that 84% of the respondents favored a surtax on millionaires. This provision was dropped around that time from a Democratic-Republican budget compromise. Even though 51% of the respondents were in favor of raising the capital gains tax, neither major party favored that. A Harris-Harvard School of Public Health poll of 1989 showed that most Americans, 61%, favored a Canadian-type health system in which the government was the single payer to doctors and hospitals, bypassing the insurance companies and offering universal medical coverage to everyone. Neither the Democratic nor the Republican Party adopted that as its program, although both insisted they wanted to reform the health system. A survey by the Gordon Black Corporation for the National Press Club in 1992 found that 59% of all voters wanted a 50% cut in defense spending in 5 years. Neither of the major parties was willing to make major cuts in the military budget. How the public felt about government aid to the poor seemed to depend on how the question was put. Both parties and the media talked incessantly about the welfare system, that it was not working, and the word welfare became a signal for opposition. When people were asked, a New York Times CBS News poll of 1992, if more money should be allocated to welfare, 23% said no. But when the same people were asked, should the government help the poor, 64% said yes. This was a recurring theme. When at the height of the Reagan presidency, in 1987, people were asked if the government should guarantee food and shelter to needy people, 62% answered yes. Clearly, there was something amiss with a political system supposed to be democratic, in which the desires of the voters were repeatedly ignored. They could be ignored with impunity so long as the political system was dominated by two parties, both tied to corporate wealth. An electorate forced to choose between Carter and Reagan, or Reagan and Mondale, or Bush and Dukakis, could only despair or decide not to vote, because neither candidate was capable of dealing with a fundamental economic illness whose roots were deeper than any single presidency. That illness came from a fact which was almost never talked about, that the United States was a class society, in which 1% of the population owned 33% of the wealth, with an underclass of 30 to 40 million people living in poverty. The social programs of the 60s, Medicare and Medicaid, food stamps, etc., did not do much more than maintain the historic American maldistribution of resources. While the Democrats would give more help to the poor than the Republicans, they were not capable, indeed not really desirous, of seriously tampering with an economic system in which corporate profit comes before human need. There was no important national movement for radical change, no social democratic or democratic socialist party, such as existed in countries in Western Europe, Canada, and New Zealand. But there were 1,000 signs of alienation, voices of protest, local actions in every part of the country to call attention to deep-felt grievances, to demand that some injustice be remedied. For instance, the Citizens Clearinghouse for Hazardous Wastes in Washington, D.C., which had been formed early in the Reagan administration by housewife and activist Lois Gibbs, reported that it was giving help to 8,000 local groups around the country. One of these groups, in Oregon, brought a series of successful lawsuits to force the Environmental Protection Agency to do something about unsafe drinking water in the Bull Run Reservoir near Portland. In Seabrook, New Hampshire, there were years of persistent protest against a nuclear power plant which residents considered a danger to themselves and their families. Between 1977 and 1989, over 3,500 people were arrested in these protests. Ultimately, the plant, plagued by financial problems and opposition, had to shut down. Fear of nuclear accidents was intensified by disastrous events.